Okay, that was, well, actually, what song was that again? Sorry, I don't remember.
Overnight Sensation by the Raspberries.
Overnight Sensation by the Raspberries. Yeah, I mean, it didn't sound familiar. The sound sounded familiar, but not the song itself. But so that's Ear Buddies wrapping up for the day. You are listening to WMFO Medford, WMFO in Medford, also known as Tufts Freeform Commercial Free Community Based Radio. And we're a little slice that community based. We're socialist alternative radio. Take care, Ear Buddies. And we are talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And we're going to bring that to you here today. We have lots of stuff to talk about. The strike, I won't call it a strike wave, but the upsurge in strikes in this country is pretty impressive compared to recent years. And then we also have the protests happening around the world that even the corporate media is noticing a little bit. The string of protests from Chile to Haiti to Lebanon to Hong Kong to, you know, you're going to hear a lot about the Hong Kong one, of course, because some of the corporate media insists on calling China communist. Now, they gave up that ghost a long time ago. They are state capitalists. They have billionaires, many, many billionaires in the leadership of the so-called Communist Party. They've just, you know, taken over the sort of iconography and the latent support that that revolution had going back to not that long ago, really, 1949, the sort of Maoist-Stalinist revolution there. But the current Communist Party, I mean, they, you know, they took a turn in the early 90s, and they basically gave the infrastructure they'd created out of the chaos of capitalism and colonialism that had made this huge country of China a desperately poor country up until the revolution. They took the gains made of the revolution, and they just, handed it over in terms of infrastructure, in terms of economic gains, and they just handed it over to privatization and capitalist development. Both internal, creating a capitalist class within China, and inviting in the multinational corporations to exploit the heck out of, and that's putting it so nicely, the Chinese people. And now we hear a picture of China as this paradise, a capitalist paradise of wealth and so on, and the reality, of course, is deep poverty continues, deep inequality continues, and nationalism is on the rise, that's for sure, because whenever you have a rising middle class, in a true sense of the word, meaning as Marx would say, Marxists would say, petty bourgeois or middle class owners, small owners, when you ever have a rising amount of that, and in this case, a rising bourgeois created again by the Stalinists, by their policies, then you'll have certainly a rise in nationalism. Because that is what is going to cement the power of the state, which the capitalists need to survive as a system and as a class, and they in control of that state by the capitalists, in this case, the so-called Communist Party of China. Capitalist states that control the capitalist economy to take many forms. Historically, they've been mixed, economies in the sense of the United States. You had the rise of capitalism. And slave economy at the same time couldn't exist together. You had the clash of the Civil War, obviously, and capitalism really taking off in 1866 after the Civil War in this country. But you had other countries that the transition from either feudalism or slave society, slave economies into slave labor based economies into capitalism. You know, it was a revolutionary process in many cases, was a messy process, a bloody coercive process in many cases, and for the capitalists to seize power and to prevent the next revolution from happening, the revolution of the working class internationally, socialism internationally, of the people that actually do the work, the billions of people around the globe that have been drawn into the capitalist economy and as workers, as people that actually, you know, run things in the sense of brain power and labor power together, being exploited by a tiny minority that actually don't run anything, they actually don't create anything, they just control everything. And the state is so fundamental to that, the government is so fundamental to that control, they make sure they create a system where loyalty and blind loyalty as much as possible to the state is inculcated, is indoctrinated into the working class. And in whatever country, that's why all this stuff about globalization and the international aspects of capitalism, They're a dual thing. It's really a dialectical process where, on the one hand, yes, corporations are setting up all around the world, and they get to the point where they seem to be above nation states, above governments. But in reality, they always rely back on one primary government to be their stick, their big military might, to gain market share, to go to where they can exploit labor, to knock down environmental and labor regulations, to stop movements, anti-capitalist movements, to try to stop revolutions against capitalism. They always rely ultimately on a nation state. And those, of course, nation states can be in alliance with other capitalist nation states to keep capitalism going. That is how it is. But they also compete with each other. So that's the part that seems contradictory, but it also results in that tension between competition but also defending the interests of capitalism is a reality under capitalism. It's part of the same process. You can go back to the French, the Paris Commune in 1871, where you had the French and German armies, new capitalist armies, fighting each other over territory and natural resources and so on. And a desperate battle all of a sudden is stopped when a desperate war is stopped when the people, the new working class in Paris and around Paris decides to revolt and against the privations and the conditions of their lives as under capitalism and made worse by the war. They revolt. They have a socialist revolution, essentially. I mean, it has different aspects to it that with different names, but essentially it's a socialist revolution where workers really organizing, everything from barricades to popular assemblies to take control over society. It was the first real socialist revolution in that sense. And way back in 1871. And all of a sudden, the Germans stop fighting and meet with the French, and the two bitter bourgeois enemies, the two bitter nation states as enemies, all of a sudden made an agreement to allow the French army to stop fighting the Germans, and the Germans would stop fighting, and the French army would then march into Paris and slaughter men, women, and children that were trying to liberate themselves from capitalism, basically. And that's what happened. If you ever are lucky enough to fly over there and go to Paris, off the usual tourist path, there's a cemetery. Actually, it is part of well-known tourism. There's a cemetery in the middle of, not in the middle of Paris, but in Paris, called Père Lachaise, and that's where Jim Morrison's buried, by the way. And so that gets some attention through that. And Oscar Wilde, who was a socialist, by the way, and others are buried there. And so Edith Piaf is buried there. And so people go to Père Lachaise to look at the graves of these people they admire and perhaps still read their works, listen to their music, and so on. And but there's a wall there called Le Mur de Fédéral, and that is also known as the Wall of the Communards. And that's where, at the end of the desperate battle of the barricades and so on against the French army coming in, slaughtering its own citizens, the people, men, women, and children fighting back, were captured. Many of them, I think it was 800 to 1,000 in this case, lined up against the wall that still exists, though, this wall in Père Lachaise Cemetery, and murdered by the French army. And so that wall and the people that are woke to the history of working class revolt, of revolution, they leave flowers there, and it's in a part of the cemetery with resistance fighters from World War II, resistance against the Nazis, and other heroes of the left are buried in that part of the cemetery. So whenever I go there, and I've been there a few times, I haven't been there for many, many years, but when I was younger and traveling on a shoestring and all that, blah, blah, getting into debt and everything. So many years ago, I would go there I went there more than once, and I'd always bring 2 dozen roses to put down on the wall of the communards. So the state right now, basically I was talking about the Chinese Communist Party, and yeah, they're trying to get this hyper nationalism going in China. It's working to a certain extent. And that's, there to really cement their system, and to create a blind loyalty, plus the repression they use. They even have this thing you've probably been reading about. I don't know how true it is. I haven't researched it, but some sort of citizenship algorithm, judging people based on information they can gather about them, about how patriotic and nationalistic they are. And then if they're failing if they're not doing that well in their and their judgment and their score, let's call it, maybe it's like a credit score, you know, which has, by the way, horrible implications here, your credit score, that we can get into the political control and economic control credit scores are part of. But anyway, here in the West, in China, if this is true, this algorithm tracing citizenship and then like shutting you off from benefits and so on if you don't qualify, that's completely horrific. But it's based on an old strategy, which is followed here by the capitalist class here, of inculcating blind loyalty into nationalistic symbols, creating fear of foreigners, fear of the other, saying your country's the greatest in the world. And when you think about it, you step back and say, wait a minute, I'm a human being. I could have been born anywhere. Would that country have been the greatest in the world if I'd been born there? I mean, someone was born in another country, so they're bad. They were actually, nature, biology created their birth happening in another place. And so that means that they're inferior to me in some way, or it's their fault that they were born there. If it's a country that's in poverty or operating in a repressive way or something, turn that on the United States. I've been traveling around the world to a certain extent, not too much compared to some people, but a little bit. And I used to get mad at the assumptions that would be made about Americans, it used to piss me off that I would be, without them knowing me at all, they would just lump me in with the worst behavior they'd seen Americans doing overseas or the worst policies of the American government. And, I'd try to patiently explain, don't think everyone in America agrees with the government, at a given moment, or agrees with the economic system even. There are a minority of us, perhaps a growing minority now, and polls indicate that at least, and other things, a growing minority of people that are socialists, that are very critical of capitalism, that want to see a change to socialism, so you have to explain that to people. I haven't, again, been traveling in a long time, just don't have the money, but what's it like traveling overseas now in the age of Trump? Are you an apologist for a country that's elected Trump, or for people that really knew their stuff in other countries? Were you an apologist for people electing Obama or Clinton or other people that then went and did things in terms of like Obama's drone war or Clinton's bombing of Yugoslavia or whatever, or economic policies against immigrants in the Obama administration? Not as obvious as Trump's, but still there. What would our response be as Americans, as people born in America traveling overseas? Are we supposed to defend the policies of the U.S. government that we don't agree with, that plenty of people don't agree with? I mean, it's just that kind of unquestioning, that kind of, anyway, back to the point, without too much subtlety, that kind of, blind patriotism and nationalism serves an economic purpose ultimately. That's why money is put into that, actual material resources are put into making sure that kind of brainwashing happens at an early age, a very early age, and that is continued in the corporate media every day. I unfortunately watch, read, hear a lot of corporate media as part of trying to gather data, facts, see what they're talking about, and so on. And they always throw in, it's like part of the playbook. They always got to throw in the nationalism, the patriotism, And I understand a lot of people define patriotism, a lot of working people define patriotism as a positive thing. They'll say, well, patriotic. And in their minds, that might mean agreement with every repressive thing the U.S. government does internationally, every war, every drone strike or whatever. There's right-wing working people. But on the other hand, it might just mean that patriotism is defined as, I care about where I'm from, I care about the community where I'm from, I care about the city where I'm from, I care about, the people I know. And I would just find another label for that. I would just call that solidarity, and it doesn't have to be wrapped up in a flag, because every flag is, every flag, every national boundary really just obscures the fact that we're all most people in the world are working people, and we have common interests, including overthrowing capitalism ultimately and having a better system. that will not destroy the planet in various ways through environmental destruction or nuclear war or such severe inequality that there's constant warfare. The competition of capitalism among the capitalists themselves, which I started out talking about, that generates constant warfare around the globe, even at times where it seems like there's not a big world war going on. So, you know, when you look around, my original point of getting riffing on all that was that, the Hong Kong demonstrations, out of a whole slew of demonstrations happening internationally, which we'll get into, are... are the ones that get featured mostly. You know, you haven't heard much about the demonstrations in Haiti. You haven't heard much about the demonstrations in Lebanon, but some has gotten through into the corporate media and the sort of the ruling class in the United States, the capitalist class that owns the corporate media. They're a bit alarmed, you know, so they allow a op-ed piece or two or maybe an article or two to talk about. There was an interesting piece in the Washington Post, very right-wing paper in a lot of ways. Actually, you know, again, if you listen to the show, you know that liberal equals pro-capitalist, conservative equals pro-capitalist, you know, right-wing, you know, pro-capitalist plus, you know, policies that, you know, are more overtly racist than institutional racism that many liberals would defend, not unknowingly or ignorantly. So anyway, you know, it's all a spectrum of pro-capitalism until you get to the left, the real left, left of the Democratic Party, in terms of electoral politics, left of the, accepted corporate education version of history. And to the left of conservative union leaders that support without flinching the Democrats and the Republicans, even in some cases. So in terms of the crossover electoral politics into economics, they don't call it political economy for nothing. If you actually study look up Marxism and so on. These protests are, this Washington Post article was, very interesting because it quoted some sociologists. It was an op-ed piece, an opinion piece, I believe. And unfortunately don't have it in front of me. Don't have a printer at home anymore because can't afford one. Yeah. Actually, my wife says that we can get one for like $50. But there's times like right now where you don't even spend, we can't even spend $50. I mean, we're trying watching every penny till our next paycheck. And then the cycle starts again. But anyway, and by the way, you know, it's interesting. Marx talked about that economics. And he said, and other Marxists have mentioned this, why don't workers get paid the minute they start work? You know, I mean, you put in a day's work when you start a new job, you put in a week's work, maybe 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks in some jobs, maybe a month in some jobs, and you haven't seen a paycheck yet. But life goes on. You have to eat. You have to get transportation. You have to get clothing. You have to get, all the stuff you need to survive. You have to get stuff for your kids or whatever if you have children. And here we are not getting paid in a new job until, you know, whatever their pay schedule is, you know. And they pocket all that interest of all the value you've added, you know, until you get paid. And then you finally get paid less than the value of what you've added to the economic process. That's called the labor theory of value. That's what happens that's the basis of all profits in capitalism. And so Marx and others said, well, hey, why not pay the workers right away? Why not that first day? Why don't you get paid on a daily basis? Why don't you pay on an hourly basis? I'd like it if every hour of my miserable wage slave life, some supervisor had to walk over and drop, you know, whatever my hourly wage is, I'm not even sure what it is right at this point, into my hand. I'm kind of sure what my hourly wage is. Don't take me wrong. But after taxes and deductions for family health insurance and useless medical dental insurance and useless life insurance and stuff like that, I wonder what I don't know the exact hourly wage after deductions. But I know I can figure out my net pay versus my gross pay, which we should all be going by net pay statistics, by the way. Gross pay is a fantasy in this country. And you know, and yet I'm, anyway, so I would like whatever my exact net hourly pay is to be just, you know, left on my desk in an envelope or put in my hand with a little handshake. Thank you for your hour of wage slavery. And I'll take that money, and I'll be able to budget for real, you know, at that point. And at the end of the day, I got this little pile of money, and you know, that's going to be true. There's some true budgeting. Now at the end of the week, same problems, right? Probably, maybe a little less, but same basic problem of not enough of that money to do what's needed, like just to complain. Everyone's got their complaints, and everyone's got their personal survival strategies. Like, I was complaining to a coworker about the cost of tires now, right? To get if you have to drive, if you have a car, and believe me, I spent most of my adult life without a car, so I don't want to hear from the bike riders or anybody that, you know, with their personal survival strategies, their personalized environmental martyrdom. That is useless. Completely useless, as we've said in many shows. The stats are there. Most pollution comes from heavy industry. It comes from big corporations and the military. All the consumer pollution tied together is nothing compared to what is spewed out by the big corporations and the military. You know, and that's how it has to be tackled. Environmental pollution has to be tackled on a systemic level, an international level. Can't be tackled in one household. Good luck. Do all the recycling and bike riding you want. That's great. I love it. But you're not solving the environmental crisis at all. Zero. You know, they had Jane Fonda on National Propaganda Radio the other day. And, you know, I admire Jane Fonda to a certain extent, because of the stuff she's had to go through, taking certain positions she's taken, you know, against the Vietnam War and so on. But she's always been just a liberal, basically, you know, example of sort of, you know, wealthy liberal, you know, mixing it up with the workers a little bit in certain cases or not. Now she's doing these symbolic environmental protests. Okay, you know, that's good, I guess, in terms of getting out a little knowledge about the thing. But come on. I mean, you know, it's not going to solve anything, unfortunately. And I'm not even sure it's going to organize in the right way, because work people are going to look at that and say, I can't get arrested every Friday. I can't afford this, you know, permanent activism thing. And hopefully it occurs to some of us, occurs to me and others I know, that we need our own political party. We need a socialist party of some sort, a workers' party of some sort that will be part of doing what we can. And then collectively we'll be fighting on electoral politics and in the streets, on protests and in issues and so on. That's going to be the power. And that's what was my original point. The Washington Post had a very interesting, I think it was an op-ed piece again, I'll bring it in next time, where they said, the sociologists said, we've looked at all these demonstrations and figured out which ones are protest movements, sorry, which ones are effective and which ones aren't. And they came to the conclusion of Marxists. It was just really amazing. They came to a Marxist conclusion, a socialist conclusion, which was that the most effective mass protests are those where working people are involved through unions, through working political parties, you know, and the ones that stay in the realm of the upper middle class in any society, like the environmental movement, unfortunately, at this point, like a lot of student movements, so on, these can be beaten back and are by governments. And they end up being ineffectual. Does that mean that every single protest movement where workers' parties are involved and unions are involved and workers are involved wins the day? Not necessarily, of course. And what they win might not be a social revolution. It just is a changing of the guard or something. But it's they're more effective in the goals they're trying to get overall than the ones that are led by the upper middle class. Even upper class people, and primarily working on you know, NGO models or models of protest of just, you know, involving students. So I'm not trashing students at all. Students can play a huge role in sparking protests, in helping helping move protests forward. But it should always be from the standpoint of trying to get it sometimes is, sure, trying to get more working people involved, trying to get the unions involved, trying to get a new party going to the left of the Democrats and the Republicans, obviously, in this country is the task we have ahead of us. Anyway, so getting back to what we had planned to do today is to talk more in depth about those protests. But before that, we're going to talk about the union movement here in the United States. As small as it is historically, relatively speaking, historically, and it is relatively small, relatively weak. It's a potentially very powerful movement, even in its weakened state. And it's showing some of that power in 2018 and this year in 2019. It's reemerged. And the even the corporate media talks about this a little bit. This is alternative media called In These Times, a liberal website, inthetimes.com. And they tried to summarize some of what's been happening recently in the labor movement. And I really want to get into that, not so much for the newsy aspect of it, because again, if you listen to this show, Socialist Alternative Radio, in case you just tuned in, you're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective here on WMFO 91.5 FM, also known as Tufts Educational Radio, Tufts Freeform Radio, etc. We're not just about this kind of alternative news model that you can find here or there on left or progressive radio in weak state, let's admit it, in weak college-based state radio stations usually, which is fine. I mean, that serves a purpose. But what's lacking, of course, in the country and in the world dominated by corporate media, by capitalist media, where the capitalists control the big media centers, whether it's in television or radio or whatever, you know, we're in this little fringe here, which I appreciate, by the way. Don't get me wrong. Been doing this for a long time. What we're trying to do here with our little show in a very modest way is just add to help along people who want to get serious about socialism and about learning more, but about becoming active as socialists. That's a key point. So we're here not just, you know, advocating, educate yourself and all that. That's part of it, right? And alternative news, you know, finding out what's really going on in society is a part of that education, obviously. But I know a lot of people, very nice people I've been friends with over the years who that's where they stop. You know, they stop at try to figure things out through a sort of liberal left media slant, and they'll read things like In These Times or whatever, but then they'll pursue whatever little hobbies they have or whatever, and the little free time they have, they will not engage at the level of trying to help organize things, of being part of a larger movement, being a member of a socialist group, or you know, even go beyond voting for the corporate elites. They'll talk tough one day, and then the next day they're voting Democrat. I mean, it makes no sense from the standpoint of fundamental change, from the standpoint of socialism. So or voting Republican or whatever. Pick your poison. Pick your ping pong side, the duopoly of the corporate parties. So this show's about really at its essence trying to inspire people or motivate people or just make people slightly curious about a thing called socialism, a real movement, a real historically provable sort of phenomena and movement. And once you get into it, of course, you find out that there's people out there calling themselves socialists that are basically liberals and voting Democrat and so on. That's unfortunately, especially in the U.S., that's just a disease of the American left that is one reason why the labor movement is so weak. But with the labor movement's somewhat resurgence, and hopefully this will continue, then, of course, there's going to be people like me talking about, hey, we need our own political voice. We need our own political party to get things done. It's not happening through the Democrats. In fact, it goes backwards. I mean, look at the Chicago teachers' strike. I mean, I'm sure you had labor leaders in Chicago supporting the mayor that got elected through, you know, the lens of she's a liberal, identity politics, she's a woman of color, et cetera, you know. That's not enough politically, you know. There's plenty of of people of color who are socialists. That would have been a much better choice for mayor and run in a different party, not the Democrats or Republicans, but in some sort of works party. That could happen. Read Black Agenda Report, for example, if you want to know about, or other sources that if you want to know about black socialists that run, you know, as left greens or however they can get on the ballot as independents. And you don't have to pretend that diversity only exists in a fringe of the Democratic Party in certain places, in certain areas. Know that diversity exists in the socialist movement, exists in the general anti-capitalist left, and there's a lot of choice out there that you know isn't dependent on a superficial analysis of where someone might come from because they look a certain way. And sure enough, the mayor of Chicago becomes all of a sudden uses all her energy and her supporters' energy in the Democratic Party to try and screw over the Chicago teachers when they're on strike in various ways, and managed to screw them up a little bit. But I don't know if we have time to get into it. I had a plan today of getting into the details of the settlements, the Chicago teacher strike and the UAW GM strike that just happened, but I don't think we're gonna have time for that. I'll point to some sources where you can get the information if that's the case. We don't have time. But here's an overview of many different strikes I wanted to point out. This is from In These Times from October 28th. So it said, over the last week, at least 85,000 workers were out on strike. We're out on 13 different strikes. Out meaning out of work, on strike, and 13 different strikes. 13 doesn't sound that big, and in some ways it's not compared to previous times in U.S. history. But the that's a lot of workers in some of those strikes, adding up to 85,000 out in 1 week. So according, this is by Michael Arria, A-R-R-I-A, from In These Times, October 28th, 2019. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 485,000. I've also seen that statistic as 500,000. U.S. workers were involved in strikes and lockouts during 2018. So that was last year, right? Now that's the highest number since 1986. And we've talked about that before on the show. Now the data for 2019 won't be released until next year, 2020, which is coming up quick. But there's a good chance that number will be exceeded, that number of 500,000 or 485,000. And that's a point driven home by the fact that over the last week, there were at least 85,000 workers participating in 13 different strikes across the United States. The crest of the strike waves primarily, this says school workers. I'm not sure that's exactly true, but there's a grain of truth there. About 26,000 Chicago teachers at the time of the writing this article were on strike for 12 days. That strike's been settled. They mentioned this mayor the way that I mentioned as well. Lori Lightfoot be held accountable for her campaign promise to bolster support staff and decrease class size. All of a sudden, like every other Democrat, when she got elected, the money wasn't there all of a sudden, despite the campaign promises. And believe me, you'll see that happen with any Democrat right now, whether it's Warren, Sanders, any of them that claim, I don't care if they claim to be socialist like Sanders or whatever, if they run as a Democrat, when they get in to power, playing ball with the Democratic Party, all of a sudden the money's not going to be there for the things they promised they would try to enact or try to fight for or whatever as Democrats. They're going to bow to the logic of the market. Because they're part of a corporate political party. Especially if you claim to be any kind of socialist, that means, you know, talking about having the methods of material analysis there, historical materialism, dialectical materialism, then you're going to be able to, then you have to say, well, look, I can't separate this individual candidate, Bernie Sanders, from the institution he's been a part of since 1992, basically, and very loyal part of. Look at 2016, what he did. He didn't get the nomination, despite alleged fixing of it and so on, which is probably true, that through the DNC, then why did he still remain loyal, not only to promoting Clinton, but to the party itself, to the Democratic Party itself? Some U.S. socialists never learn. They never learn. They claim to care about history, then all of a sudden history doesn't matter. We're in a new period, some of them say, a new period. We're just going to throw out the whole method of historical materialism and concentrate on what happened yesterday or just moments ago with the old problem, and it is a problem actually, of left populism, of someone from a corporate political party talking like a progressive or a socialist. But they're in the institution that is there to prevent progressivism and socialism from ever, real progressivism and socialism from ever emerging in this country. It's part of the institute. I mean, the government has other ways of trying to stop that as well. But politically, the Democratic Party plays that role. It's supposed to soak up everything mildly to the left at times of the Republican Party. And now, the reason I say at times is there's an interesting thing happening with the impeachment stuff. And if you're wondering why we're not talking about impeachment more, then we could. It's got a lot of lessons to it. Trump should be impeached. Trump should be in prison. You know, that I think goes without saying to a certain extent. But is Trumpism, and I'm not the only one saying this, other people, even liberals are saying this, I've heard, is Trump, is he the problem alone? No, of course not. Trump comes from somewhere. Trump is part, again, of an organization. You can't separate Trump from the Republican Party as much as Mitt Romney or someone might want to do that. It's not true. Trump comes from the Republican Party. And he does things that the corporate CEOs and a lot of Republicans just love to death. You know, he's the Trump regime is continuing attacks started by the Obama regime and other corporate regimes in terms of electoral politics, and continuing. You know, the anti-union policies, the tax policies, and bailouts of big corporations and all that kind of stuff. So you know, the Trump administration is doing severe damage to working people. There's just no doubt about that. But the point that I was going to, and you know, impeachment, great, impeach, get rid of Trump. You know, point is the next Trump, Pence, or whoever. How are you going to fight them? And then you just fight these individual battles, or do you fight the system that barfs up a Trump or a Nixon or Woodrow Wilson, Democrat, or FDR, you know, the sainted FDR, sainted JFK. Look into their policies: racism, war, poverty, keeping poverty in place, keeping racism in place, keeping war going. You know, this is again, if you're any kind of a real socialist, you can't flinch, you can't blink, you can't bow down to popular moments where someone gets a pass, regardless of what they actually do, because they bandy about the word socialism, or because they people are so desperate that they want some, they believe a lot of promises again and again, election after election, that the institution isn't there for. You know, the Democratic Party is not there for your promises, for your, you know, to get the things you need. It's there to stop you from getting the things you need. So is the Republican Party. But anyways, what I was going to make is that Trump, you know, touches on things. Again, I'm the only one saying this. I've read some astute writers, political thinkers, or whatever you want to call them, essayists. I don't know. Not all of them are professional journalists, but it includes professional journalists who have said, now it's interesting how Trump plays this right populism, how he plays that, you know, he attacks unpopular wars, right? He at times, and then he starts. He's ready to start. On the other hand, you know, I'm not, again, no illusions in Trump having a good position on anything, because he might say the right words one second, the next second he's or while he's saying those words, he's doing things that are undermining exactly what he's saying. But people hear through the corporate media, which has to genuflect before a president to have some sort of presidential authority going, because, you know, that means a lot to the system, the economic system. So to have Trump's, you know, come out against like unpopular wars or constant warfare in the Middle East, to have Trump like bring U.S. troops home, quote unquote, and then, you know, like from Syria, where he puts more in and puts more around in oil fields on the other hand. But anyway, when he makes these pronouncements and they get repeated in the corporate media that sound in some way critical of U.S. imperialism, you know, of U.S. foreign policy, of U.S. Covert policy, like, well, didn't Trump have some quote about somebody accused? I can't remember the exact details. It came out not too long ago, but he basically said the United States has a history of murdering people as well. Oh yeah, the Saudi thing where they murdered that journalist, and Trump was like, they didn't do that the right way. You know, I mean, what a horrible, cynical, murderous thing to say, right? But the way it came out in the corporate media was they challenged him. And he said, well, you know, the United States has a lot of blood on its hands that way, too. Now, that's not an exact quote, but he basically was referring to United States extrajudicial killings done by the U.S. government throughout history, including recent ones. And, you know, I don't remember if he said blood on our hands or whatever, our hands, quote unquote. That's the Democrats then. Here's the point, right? Sorry, it took so long to get there. The Democrats then do a right wing a flank maneuver, and they start appealing to, you can see, they come on all the radio shows and all the TV shows talking about this is improper for a U.S. president to question this or that. You know, they're basically bolstering U.S. imperialism. They're basically bolstering really rotten policies, you know, of repression and extrajudicial murder and wars without end. They're backing up U.S. imperialism. The same way Sanders backs up the F-35 fighter up in Vermont, and it's a good thing and creates jobs, you know? And you call yourself a socialist, and people believe it, and people call him a socialist. I mean, it's ridiculous, you know? A socialist is an internationalist. Any real socialist is also an internationalist. I got this book here I brought in today. Definitely not going to have time for it, but Eugene Debs Speaks by Pathfinder Press. 1970, the copy I have, third printing, 1980. There's a whole it's not a whole chapter, but it's a big part of a chapter where Eugene Debs, the famous U.S. socialist, extols the virtues of the Russian Revolution, right? And at the same time, it speaks against World War I, which landed him in prison, by the way. Free speech, yeah, think about that. So, anyway, so the Democrats now are not at all ashamed of outright winging Trump on any number of issues. And I look at that and I think about people that have illusions of the Democratic Party in terms of reforming it, in terms of splitting it, they think, in terms of voting for some but not others. And they're just helping the whole party with those policies, the whole Democratic Party. And they're keeping us down. They're keeping working people down. Because we need our own political party. And the strikes, getting back to the strikes, that's an example of where people start thinking about that kind of thing. Because here in Chicago, a lot of labor leaders supported this mayor that then came out against the strike, the big strike, and fought tooth and nail to hurt the strike, and prevailed in getting a mixed result in the strike, although it seems to be overall a victory. And you know, this happens again and again and again and again and again and again, and again in U.S. politics. And the left, such as it is in the United States, can't jump this hurdle. And there's reasons for it. There's historical reasons for it. The biggest left party yet so far was the Communist Party in the 1930s. Got up to 100,000 members by 1938. But by that time, they were consistently supporting the Democratic Party in national elections and many local elections. And they have this whole thing of they support the Democratic Party through supporting a lot of its candidates, the ones that they deem progressive or whatever. And then they have the gall to say they don't support the Democratic Party. Well, how else do you support the Democratic Party? I mean, what do you have to do? Give a donation to the DNC to prove that you really support the Democratic Party? No. You vote Democrat, you support the Democratic Party. Or you call for a vote, more importantly, in many ways. You're an organization that calls for a vote for the Democratic Party. Democratic Party candidates. Democratic Party's electoral machine exists only as an electoral machine, or primarily as an electoral machine. And so you have to, you know, no matter who you are, whether you're a liberal or a so-called lefty who votes Democrat, voting for some Democrats is what you have to do. You can't vote for all the Democrats, right? Because they run against each other. So it's a silly thing to say, because I only vote for and call for a vote for certain Democrats, I'm not for the Democratic Party. No, you are for the Democratic Party. You just helped get the Democratic Party more power by voting for its candidates, you know? And again, if there's working people out there that, you know, aren't part of an organization or they're part of like a union that endorses Democrats and so on, they can't stop that. They haven't been able to stop that yet, whatever. You know, I sympathize. You know, it's a learning process. It's a process of, seeing that there have been alternatives in the past, there will be alternatives in the future, most likely, to the Democrats, to the left of the Democrats. And I would just argue that it's better to search around for individual, independent, left independent or progressive independent candidates, to look for left greens to vote for, to look for, you know, have to do a protest vote if you have to, you know. But don't think that you're helping anyone or anything by putting in one corporate power party versus another one. Trump is horrible. Trump doesn't come from nowhere. There are little Trumps that add up to one big Trump in the Democratic Party. You know, it's not. It's just not rhetoric. You have to listen to. You have to look at the deeds. You have to look at what people do when they're in power. So, this Lori Lightfoot could be the mayor of Chicago. You could be seeing him anyway. So the opposite of Trump, and I'm sure has better policies than Trump in a lot of ways. But ultimately, where the intersection between Lori Lightfoot and Trump exists is on the economy, the capitalist economy, which affects everything else. So you can have the most progressive social policies you could think of. Or say you're for those, and then undercut the funding for the things that are necessary for people to have equality in this country, not just economic equality, but social equality as well. Well, the two things are inextricably linked, but anyway. So this article, again, it's any time it makes an interesting point here. I'm not sure I agree with it totally, but it's an interesting point. Quote, and they're quoting someone on this, Hundreds of CTU, Chicago Teachers Union members, showed up for the Wisconsin Uprising of 2010. Remember that? We've talked about that on the show before. When a lot of union members and working people showed up at the state capitol in Madison to fight the reactionary policies of the ex-Governor Walker. I love saying ex-Governor Walker, by the way. That scumbag. Remember he ran for president? He was riding a motorcycle around. So happy that guy is. Oh, although he's getting paid, God knows what, doing whatever he does now, because they reward those people. You know, they're not. He's probably working for some Democratic Party thing now, for all you know. I mean, it's probably actually a Republican thing, but you know, people leave the revolving door. I mean, I learned about this in sociology class way back, and you can find out about it. It's so easy to read about and find out that, you know, 1 minute you're in the government, the next minute you're working for some prestigious law firm, you know, or financial house, financial, you know, venture capital thingy, or some think tank run by the government, by the Democrats and Republicans, you know, blah, blah. And the reason I throw that in is because there's overlap between the parties once it gets back into so-called civilian life or non-governmental life, where you could be at a prestigious law firm that has a mix of high-profile Democrats and Republicans, et cetera. Anyway, maybe too subtle a point for what we're talking about here. We're just basically talking about how this author makes the point, or through quoting, that through the Wisconsin Rising 2010, Chicago activist and striking teacher Kenzo Shibata told in these times, "We learned what was possible, and we continued to organize for our 2012 strike." And then educators in West Virginia, Los Angeles, Oklahoma, and Arizona cited that 2012 strike as an inspiration for their strikes. Solidarity is contagious. Love that point. People learn from experience. They like to say we're stupid. They say workers are stupid. Working people are stupid. We're not stupid. We're not stupid. We just can't always take the same risks at the moment you want us to take these risks. And by the way, who is you and who are us is a big question. A lot of people, again, in the United States, with the absence of a workers' party of any sort, liberals are often in charge of movements. And I don't know about you, but it makes me suspicious if a rich person is talking about inequality and minimum wage, this and that, you know? And we have the unfortunate crime of, you know, socialists often putting up liberal, wealthy people, or those that represent the wealthy, as leaders of movements that they have no business being leaders of, in fact, aren't. They wouldn't be put up as leaders except that the left party and the Communist Party used to excel at this. They would put up someone they felt was a good spokesperson, a liberal, rich liberal, to lead a movement that they could have led themselves, or they could have had working class organizations, or working class organizations and leaders, you know. And that's the whole thing about Popular Front versus United Front, coalition and movement work. We have a situation where the first instinct of a lot of labor leaders, a lot of even people that call themselves socialists, is to throw up some Democrat as a spokesperson, some rich liberal as a spokesperson for a movement that's essentially a labor movement. That's essentially a movement of working people. Don't be afraid of that. put up someone as a leader that maybe isn't as polished a speaker, but they know in their heart who what side they're on. You know what I mean? They're accountable. They're more accountable to their friends and family and neighborhood and the union and whatever the organization is than they are to a rising career in NGO-dom, you know? Read Aaron Hadi Roy's NGOization of politics or whatever that was called, you know? There's a lot of movements that get buried in the Democratic Party, and part of that burial of individuals of left and progressive interest movements is careerism, you know? You're going to get this job as a rich lawyer and a rich NGO type. And of course that comes along with voting Democrat, because we're all friends here, of course, you know, blah, blah, blah. Blur the class lines, not even understand class to begin with, social class, and just do what sounds vaguely progressive and miss completely the root of the problem, or the roots of the problems in the institutions and daily functioning of capitalism and the institutions that defend capitalism on a routine basis. To have in your mind what's acceptable. There's a lot of self-censorship, unfortunately, in the so-called left in the United States. What's acceptable to say publicly, you know? What isn't? And they make a lot of assumptions there, because things change. Now there's all these strikes going on, right? You'd think that more labor leaders would be talking about striking, and more labor leaders would be talking about organizing, you know? And more labor leaders would be talking about dumping the Democratic Party, the drain on our resources the Democratic Party is. Part of my union dues is going to the Democratic Party. I resent that. I don't want that. I have no way of stopping that. There's not enough democracy in my union to stop that. But I think from the outside, that could end, you know, through the upsurge of a workers' party, or the beginnings of one even. That could come back into my union, and democracy or not, we'll make the channels for that to happen, to stop being a bankrolling the Democratic Party, our enemies, really, when it comes right down to it. And the class enemies, you know, the class lines are constantly blurred in a country with low class consciousness to begin with, the United States, and no workers' party, which in turn contributes to the low class consciousness. You know, and so you have a lot of people that are so-called left, so-called progressive, labor leaders, community leaders, whatever, that then they'll get in a struggle, and the first thing they'll think of is, what prominent liberal jerk can we bring, they don't say jerk, I'm saying it, can we bring into this to be the face of this struggle? No, you use your own face, you use your own people are the face of the struggle. You don't put up, like there was unfortunately some so-called socialists. They got involved in the Oakland teacher strike, and one of the first things they did was try to get Bernie Sanders to come and speak at the strike. Screw that. Screw that. If Sanders wants to support the strike, fine, right? But that's not what you lean on. You lean into your own strength. You develop your own leaders. You bring out the rank and file people to speak from their heart about how hard it is to live on pay that hasn't gone up in a decade or whatever, you know? How hard, that's the voices, that's the new leadership we need. Bring up the youth, bring a high school student onto the podium that supports the strike. And all these teacher strikes I've read about, by the way, the high school students are totally supportive. Or I won't say totally, but the huge majority are supportive of the teachers. Some of them helping on the picket lines. And then you're going to bring in some celebrity politician who claims to be a socialist and really isn't to talk about the strike. Why? Because maybe that gets you more media coverage or something or whatever. No, you don't need it. You don't need it. Strings are attached to more media coverage. Strings are attached to vague promises of local Democrats doing something on the city council. What usually happens in strikes in the United States that are bitter strikes that go on for a while and so on is that workers and even reluctantly union leaders start thinking about how to get around the Democratic Party city council, how to get around the Democratic legislature, or in some cases Republican governors or legislatures or so on, because they're hurting the strike, right? In here in Massachusetts, you had the Democrats threatening, saying it's illegal for public sector workers to go on strike, which it is in, I believe, in most states, or maybe all states, and starting to threaten some sort of jailing or something, which usually doesn't happen. I mean, these things have been illegal for decades, right? Public sector strikes in many states. And yet, very rarely, it only happened a few times, like in the 90s and into the 2000s, where big business felt, the corporations felt comfortable enough in a given area to actually start arresting teachers en masse, you know, or to throw labor leaders into prison. That happens more often because of technically being illegal. I mean, the labor movement used to be illegal. Unions used to be illegal. Much of what we need to do to survive and build a movement that we need for just plain reforms, not to mention socialism, is illegal and going to be more illegal. The Trump administration is doing all sorts of behind-the-scenes National Labor Relations Board stuff, crimes, basically, against working people that will result in a lot of things being illegal. Now, again, if you get a workers' party in power or even a Democrat that you put a lot of pressure on, or even a Republican you put a lot of pressure on, you can get those laws, you know, removed quickly. But it's sort of a quantitative effect, too. You know, they pass a lot of laws, like the Taft-Hartley Act itself, passed by Democrats, ultimately, what is got so many, like, tentacles to it that, yeah, a lot of it is has to be, the law has been and is continuing to be broken just for the unions to survive. But also, the goal of getting rid of it, a lot of people don't mention that, you know. I don't put it past some left populist Democrat mentioning that from time to time. They don't really mean it. If you get a workers' party going in this country, a workers' party of some sort, that's got to be high on the agenda. Get rid of Taft-Hartley. Boom. Get rid of all that stuff. Solidarity strikes illegal? Nah. No, they're not. We need them. In fact, in this strike of one of these strikes I was going to mention here, the Teamsters refused to do to deliver goods. That can be deliver stuff. That could be interpreted as a solidarity strike. It kind of isn't, obviously, because the Teamsters aren't going on strike alongside. But if they did, that'd be even stronger, you know. Or in a GM strike, other little Mack trucks strike and other strikes happened while the big UAW strike was going on, and that was done in order to take advantage of that. Now, that could be considered a solid strike. The legalism that gets unions around that sometimes, not enough, but sometimes, is their contracts happen to be coming up around the same time as a big strike is happening. So then they can turn that into, hey, we're just going out on strike because of our contract, but we also like what this other union is doing. That's got to be, we don't need that finesse. That doesn't work for enough people, enough times. We need to be able to say, we're going on strike because we support those other people over there going on strike. And then the corporations are under real pressure in a given area. Or maybe across the country. I mean, imagine when the UPS workers went on strike in 1997, which was ended up being a successful strike. Imagine if the Airline Pilots Association also went on strike. All of a sudden, nothing is moving, hardly, you know? What if other Teamster locals went on strike in addition to the UPS workers who were in the Teamsters? Whoa, all of a sudden, hardly anything's moving around the country, and the employers will be running to get some sort of settlement, you know, or calling out the troops, and the troops will say, wait a minute. Sometimes the troops say, wait a minute. Because the Army, if you go into the National Guard level, the National Guard level of the Army, you're talking about a lot of workers. It's not like the cops. It's not like people like cops that are, you know, a lot of them are working class, but they are paid so much, and they're indoctrinated so much into the, you know, the whole cop aura, you know, don't tell on other cops and all that kind of stuff. The violence, cops' lives matter more than everyone else's lives and all that kind of thing. That isolates them. That isolates them from society to a certain extent, the cops. But the military, drawing from the working class for its, you know, soldiers, rank and file, they, and usually not in there forever, right? Although some stay in the National Guard or whatever for a time. That's a different ballgame. They're not 100% sure all the time that soldiers are going to start shooting civilians. You know, there's that whole posse comitatus thing of, you know, you're not supposed to use soldiers against civilians. Well, the National Guard kind of, you know, gets around that. And there's been other times where that they haven't kept that in place, the ruling class, the government. But the reality is that there have been historical examples where the soldiers kind of hesitate a little bit. Or if they do not hesitate and they start firing, people just go crazy. They're just like, what, you got troops shooting at us now? Come on. This is not acceptable, obviously. And So there are limits to what big business can throw into the labor movement at a given time. Sometimes it seems like there aren't, but often there is. And if you have a general solidarity strike going, and say the trans